do we always need to have things that we like surfaced for us, or can we actually be confronted with new ideas that kind of push the boundary a little bit?
Welcome to the Book Society podcast, where we talk to interesting people about interesting books. It's really that simple. Okay, here we go. All right, this is the Book Society podcast. We are here with Dr. Professor Katie Davis, who has told me that I can call her Katie for as long as she's on my podcast. And we are talking about, I think this might be the first time this has happened in show history that you have picked a book whose author we have already had on the show.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Well, I hope that's a good thing. I'm not sure.
It's a great. Oh, no, it's great. So we've gone the other way where we've read a book and I've later contacted the author and done an episode with that author, but I don't think we've ever gone in this direction. So it's fantastic. Listeners of the show will know that I love Jacob Ward and I absolutely loved this book. I actually think that I brought it to the Miami Book Fair. I know that I recommended it to them, and then they ended up taking it. And Jake came there, and Jake and I did an interview there, which was the closing of our own little loop because I finished Schubert's Unfinished Symphony with Artificial Intelligence in 2019, and the Today Show did a story on it, and Jake was the correspondent, so he interviewed me for that.
Oh my gosh!
And I'm actually quoted in this book towards the end. Quoted in the loop.
Wow.
Yeah. So. It was a little bit of symmetry that I got to interview him about his book after he interviewed me about my project. So, Katie Davis, why did you pick this book?
Well, I chose this book because Jake Ward in the loop, I feel like he's raising an alarm about the future of our human agency. And although last week you were giving me a bit of a hard time for not being hard enough on parents and coming down harder on technology, this is actually a big fear that I have. And pretty much all of my research, I do a lot of different research. Sometimes I look at educational technologies. Sometimes I look at social media. Sometimes I look at little kids, older kids. Through all of it, what I'm concerned about is our human agency and whether or not technology can enhance it or undermine it. And I think that when I was reading this book, that's the central question is, you know, Ward is talking about artificial intelligence, which when he wrote and published the book, that was before ChatGPT kind of changed our societal conversation. And so it feels like this book was really prescient, even though the technology has been there for quite a while. But, you know, it's just so much more, it's even more relevant today in 2023 than it was even just last year, early in the year. So, this question about human agency, what makes us human? And what happens if we outsource all of our thinking and our decisions to AI? It's a question that I first posed in my first book, The App Generation, with Howard Gardner. And I just can't stop thinking about it. So I loved this book.
Yeah, it's interesting that this book is a little bit ahead of its time, as was The App Generation. Had you thought about the way that he describes these technological algorithm-based decisions as loops? Had you thought about this, or was this a new concept to you?
Well, not necessarily as a loop per se, but the idea that we can get trapped into a pattern of thinking that is very limiting and that keeps getting further and further limited. Mm-hmm. One of the chapters in The App Generation, we focus specifically on creativity. And so this is where in that chapter, I was, you know, getting pretty worried about, okay, what if we, you know, if we are relying on these technologies, and then in the case of AI, it's sampling from existing data, existing creations. And if it's using that to create something new, how new can it really be? And are we, I was thinking constantly of statistics and regression to the mean rather than like breaking out and inventing or creating something entirely new and unprecedented. I think this concept of the loop is a really good visual. It's a good metaphor for understanding and making sense of how that can happen, how we can get trapped in this loop that is just sort of self-referential and endlessly recursive.
Yeah, I think regression to the mean is a great mathematical corollary to this idea. Can you just explain that a little bit more for maybe someone who only took statistics up to like 10th grade?
Yeah, I think a great example of regression to the mean would be like if you have two really tall parents, they are probably not going to have a super, super tall kid, but they're going to have like a kid who's pretty tall, but maybe even a little bit less tall than they are. Just the way averages go when we collect data altogether, there is this tendency to go towards the average rather than something that's like sticking way out. And so it's sort of a flattening effect, I would say. And so the regression to the mean is not what you want, basically, when it comes to creativity.
Yeah, I think one of Jake's points, I know one of Jake's points because he told me that this was one of his points, is that AI and these computer-based algorithms are only ever going to give us back what we put into them. And it can be dressed up differently. But, you know, if you give it A, B, and C, it can give you back C, B, and A, but it's not going to give you X. Mm-hmm. And why do you think that's dangerous? And especially in the context of what you do, like, you know, children interacting with technology, or do you think that's dangerous?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's dangerous. I think it's dangerous for individuals and for society. So for individuals, if you are relying on AI to make all of your decisions or do all of your thinking for you, that's just stripping a really essential part of your humanity. And I'm not saying that turning to ChatGPT or any other generative AI for a creative purpose is necessarily a bad thing, but I think it can be a bad thing if it doesn't allow you or it takes away that intellectual struggle that I think is what makes us human. And, you know, the way we grapple with ideas. And if we are just outsourcing all of that intellectual struggle to some machine, I think it really does start to impinge on our humanity. And that worries me. And then for society, I worry that, okay, well, so if we're always sampling from what came before, how can we make new breakthroughs? What does this mean for creativity and in pretty much every aspect of our society? What kind of a society are we creating if we're not going to be able to break free from the loop? So yeah, that really worries me. And I actually think of this example from the book where he was talking about this online site called Wattpad. I'm not sure if you remember that part. It's so I knew about Wattpad because I study fan fiction, and there's a lot of fan fiction on Wattpad. And Jake was talking about a writer who was discovered, you know, and if it hadn't been for the algorithm of Wattpad, she would never have been discovered. She had written this kind of on her free time. She was not a professional writer. This story that she wrote became hugely successful, and it was touted as, look at this is a great example of someone who would never have been discovered. They were discovered and they had a chance to be a writer and a recognized writer. But on the other hand, the algorithm discovered her. And Jake points out that this algorithm was just kind of finding this story based on everything it knew from what made a successful story before. And so, sure, that algorithm is very effective, and sure, it's going to surface for us things that we like, but do we always need to have things that we like surfaced for us, or can we actually be confronted with new ideas that kind of push the boundary a little bit? And is there any room in the loop to make room for those kinds of experiences? And yeah, so I think that was a great example of showing how, yeah, sure, that can be good, but it's leaving out and probably closing off the possibility of discovering new forms of creativity.
Yeah, well, so this is we're into my domain now of creativity and the arts, and I remember that part of Jake's book. Was it E.L. James? Was that who the author? I don't remember. It was some like mega author. It might have been, maybe it was Stephanie Meyer, but it was some like someone who like went on to publish fabulously successful books, and that started on Wattpad. And I remember this part of his book, and just thinking like, you know, this is also what a studio executive does is they try to find something that is like something that has already been popular, but maybe mm-hmm. a little bit different. And this has been the game. The reason that studio executives work this way and the reason that record producers and people who are trying to, who are gatekeepers to the public work this way is because this is how human beings interpret art. Like the way to make something successful is to take something that is already successful and change it a little bit. And there is a very narrow and specific window of what you can change. And sometimes you can change almost everything except for one thing and it'll be fine. And sometimes you can only change one thing and it'll be fine. And sometimes you can change the wrong thing just a little bit and it'll fall right on its face. An example of this is in opera. I mean, there were people in the 16th century who were writing this crazy music that was harmonically dense and as modern as anything you would have in the 20th century. And nobody could handle it. Then there was Claudio Monteverdi, who was writing basically pretty safe music, but musically, harmonically, his music was very safe, but the way that it was performed, the way the instrumentation, the sound of it, the performance structure of it, the places that it was performed, everything was different. He changed everything about music, except for he left the harmonic content more or less the same. And it was a huge smashing success. So it has always been a game of what do you keep the same and what do you change in order to make something a hit. And like, you know, music is, I mean, by definition, or writing or anything, like, you're not going to have a smash hit by publishing something that is a bunch of nonsense words together. That would be new, I guess, but it's not intelligible. You know, you have to write, you know, your book and every other nonfiction book is arranged in, you know, chapters. There are conventions that you follow. There are narrative storytelling mm-hmm. structures that you follow. And you follow these things because people understand them. It's a language.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a good point. But still, if you're relying... So in the case of movies mm-hmm. and TV shows and the executive making choices, yes, absolutely. There's the blockbusters and all of that, and it's a formula. But there is a, albeit diminishing space, there is still a space for the indie movies and those quirky ones. And maybe they never are successful, mm-hmm. but they are, at least for now, sort of still getting made. And I say sort of because I think I recently listened to a podcast where A.O. Scott was interviewed about why he's leaving the movie reviewing at the New York Times for exactly this reason. There's mm-hmm. too many blockbusters. There's not enough of that, indie type movie that is really pushing the boundaries. And I just worry that, you know, with more and more AI, we're going to have less and less of these boundary pushing examples of creativity.
Yeah, I wonder. So I think about this a lot. And I think that this is a common fear, is that AI is going to make us less creative by feeding us the same things over and over and over again. And this was pretty much what people thought when recording became very popular, that we were just going to hear the same music over and over and over again. Music wasn't going to evolve. And what ended up happening was music evolved probably more in the last 120 years than it had in the previous 43,000 years. And that's a result of recording. And that was a result that nobody could have foreseen. And because these new technologies, to quote Dr. Mick Grierson, who's a friend of mine, that new technologies allow new affordances. There is no way we could have predicted what being able to listen to ourselves play music was going to do to our minds.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that there's certainly potential for us to have a relationship with AI, and particularly generative AI, where we're actually working together in some way to create something in a new way, in ways that we couldn't before. You know, and absolutely, there are examples in many different disciplines and domains where you can build things, like in architecture, things because of technology and computer modeling, you can design things that you never would have been able to design before that. So there's certainly the potential. Whether or not we use that potential, or enough people use that potential, I think that's a really open question. And that's the one that I think is not a given. I think there will certainly be people who find ways to use AI in really super creative ways. But if we just think about, okay, how are we going to incorporate AI into education, for instance? The last 100 years of us incorporating other technologies into education doesn't really bode well for the way we're going to do it with AI. And, you know, the potential is there. Whether or not we can use that potential at scale is definitely not guaranteed.
Yeah, the horror movie of Jake's book and the horror movie of your book are very similar to me. In that, in Jake's book, the part that scares me is that this technology doesn't have to be very good to be extremely disruptive. So people are afraid, you know, largely because of Elon Musk and James Cameron, are afraid of artificial general intelligence basically spawning a Terminator army and taking over humanity. That is, I would say that's pretty outside the realm of likely scenarios. And artificial general intelligence is not necessarily even in principle possible. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to reach that level to completely mess up the economy and to eliminate thousands and thousands of jobs. Like in my world, and you know, there's music that is really creatable by an AI. If you watch a YouTube video and you listen to that music that's like, you know, really low in the background, somebody made that, but there is not really a reason why a computer couldn't have made it. It's, you know, it's just supposed to exist. And, you know, if you go into like a mid-tier fancy hotel that has like ambient music everywhere, like it's, you know, this is, these are songs you've never heard. And it's someone like me who sits down and makes that stuff, but it would not be that hard to explain to a computer how to generate songs like that, if you, especially if you gave it the sounds to do it with. And so what scares me is, you know, that there is an economic incentive to displace expensive composers and possibly expensive researchers with AI that can do an okay. I mean, well, think about this, like for what you do, like if the kinds of analysis you do could be done worse, but for a fraction of the price by an AI, that would disrupt, you know, that would disrupt your ability to get grant money. I don't know how your world works, but that would disrupt your ability to do your job. And that ties into, you know, at the end of your book, you go into like how technology can be helpful for education and how in principle this stuff should be able to be making a race of intellectual superhumans, but we don't do that because there are economic incentives not to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Jake talks a lot about that. It's not just the technology, but it's the technology and the catalyst forces and the interaction with human tendencies. And all of that together is what seems to make him nervous. Mm-hmm. And it certainly, yeah, leaving AI into the hands of private companies is a little bit scary, I think, because the incentives are completely different than, for instance, in academia. And I appreciate, I think I was listening to him interviewed a couple of days ago, and his interview was about a year ago. But what he said he wanted to see, which I can definitely get behind, is a 5-year moratorium, like set aside the 6-month moratorium on AI, but then giving all the power to social scientists to identify, you know, all of the biases and injustices that are baked into AI and come up with a plan for addressing them. Obviously, this is not going to happen, but I think just showing that if we are just leaving it up to the capitalist forces, it's going to be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, I think it's not even, I mean, I think the capitalists are, it's a problem that just the way that money flows in our society makes this a potential huge problem, but it's also technologists and engineers. I mean, they do, I mean, I'll include myself in this class. I used AI to finish Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, and that was not an algorithmically revolutionary project, but none of us, until the project was over, none of us thought, should we do this or not? You know, that never entered the discussion. We just did it, and then, you know, this is what we came up with. And this is the ethos of Silicon Valley, right? Like move fast and break things. Just, you know, there's no thought given to like what might be the implications of releasing something like this. You just release it and hope for the best. And what is going to happen in our society, you know, capitalism has gotten us pretty far. And I think it's safe to say has lifted more people out of more poverty than any other force in human history. But there are limits, you know, and we might have reached them with this issue.
Yeah, there has to be some countervailing forces. And so I'm in an information school at the University of Washington, and we have computer scientists, data scientists, all sorts. We also have ethicists who are thinking about the ethical dimensions. And in fact, that's a really important through line through everybody's research, is we do think about, okay, you can create these things, and sometimes it's really fun to, but should you, or how can they be used? And we have that luxury, I recognize, in the context of academia. But I do, you know, the more there are ethicists in Silicon Valley, the better. And unfortunately, with all these layoffs, it's the trust and safety teams who are the first to go, and ethicists and so on.
I didn't know that there were trust and safety teams at big corporations.
Oh, yeah, there are. Yep. The trust and safety teams. I mean, I've interacted with a few of them in the context of kids and their privacy. So they're the ones who are thinking about issues of privacy and, you know, is this going to, what sorts of harms might this expose, this design feature expose to kids or, you know, things like that. And usually, and unfortunately, they're more on the periphery of the company and rather than embedded directly into product teams where they have much more say in where products go and how they're developed. But yeah, and I think that there are far fewer of them these days after all the layoffs.
Man, do you think that that's something that maybe should be outsourced to the government or like at the state or local level or at the federal level?
I mean, ideally it would be both, but this is where I agree with Jake Ward, is that regulation is needed. Sometimes I'm a little bit worried, well, often a lot worried about the kind of regulation that's going to come out of, especially, I would say, the federal government and, you know, what they're basing their decisions on. And hopefully they'll draw on evidence from researchers. But I'm not 100% convinced that they will. Well, but, you know, in a couple of years ago, the UK passed their age-appropriate design code, and it has flaws. It's not perfect. But as a direct result of passing that legislation, all of a sudden, Meta and YouTube and TikTok made actual concrete changes to the way they designed their platform for underage users. So YouTube made all of their underage accounts private by default, and they turned off autoplay. TikTok has recently set a 60-minute daily limit for underage users. And so it's just to show that the way it's designed now, it doesn't have to be designed that way. And you can compel the companies to consider young people's well-being and to make different decisions that may not in the short term help their bottom line, but hopefully in the long term when people are flourishing rather than flailing, for lack of a better word. So that can be the norm. And so that's just an example of where there you have this law, imperfect law, but it did lead to concrete changes. And so I do think we need regulation. I'm worried in the context of the US because right now, because the federal government can't seem to get its act together to pass any kind of legislation, we've got piecemeal state-by-state legislation. And so Texas wants to ban social media altogether for teens. I'm just worried about where that's going. California, I think, seems to be doing a little bit better. It modeled its law on the UK's law, and it seems to be putting more of the onus on the tech companies. But yeah, it's needed, but not necessarily going to be done really well.
Yeah, well, that's the compromise of democracy, unfortunately. I have two more questions for you. One is there anything that you wish all parents knew about technology and their children's relationship to that technology?
Yes, I wish parents, it comes back to a concept I introduced last week. The idea of dark patterns, I think, gets you a long way to understand that technology is not this monolithic category. They're different technologies and they're designed in different ways. And often they're designed in very manipulative ways to specifically manipulate our behavior. And so looking out for those dark patterns can, I think, go a long way for parents to make good decisions for their children. And I wish actually, so Common Sense Media is this great site that does a lot of reviews on different games and TV shows and apps for kids. I wish they had some sort of rating on like how many dark patterns there are in this particular technology. I think that would be a great addition that they could add. Something else that I wish all parents knew. Well, I wish this might be completely based on what you said last week. This might be something that you completely disagree with, but I wish that parents were a little less guilt-ridden when it comes to technology. And as long as I think they're keeping this framework that I introduce in the book front and center, is this experience self-directed? Is it community supported? I think that, you know, they're coming at their kids' technology use in a very intentional way. I think that's kind of like they're doing a great job and they can maybe give themselves a little bit of a break and know that they're a good enough digital parent and that that can actually be fine. There's no evidence that definitively says this is going to harm your kid and this is, you know, this is going to help them. There's evidence here and there, and that's the evidence that I introduce and talk about in the book. But this general lens, I think, again, it can take you a long way.
So some random musician is telling you you should feel horrible every time you let your kid touch a phone, and a accredited expert and PhD in the subject is telling you that you should give yourself some grace and it's fine. I will let the listener decide who to believe on that one.
It's up to you.
Up to you. Whoever you think might be more correct. So finally, the last question we ask everybody is to recommend two books for our listeners to read.
Oh my gosh. Ah, you caught me unawares. Let me see. So one book I'm reading right now is called Surveillance Capitalism. Okay, I have my two books. Yep. This is easy. So Surveillance Capitalism, I don't know if you've heard about it or read about it, but it's kind of along the lines of The Loop. Shoshana Zuboff, I think. She's a Harvard professor. But yeah, it's blowing my mind. I'm only about a quarter of a way through, but it's really good. So
it gets way weirder. You're going to love it.
Yep. I'm sure. I'm excited. And then another one. So this is nothing. Well, actually, I say it's nothing to do with technology, but it actually is very much to do with technology, but it's in a fictional world. So it's Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr. He's the one who wrote All the Things We Cannot See, or I forget that. It was a very popular book, but this is another amazing book. And it tells like many different stories across a few generations, and it looks into the future and kind of, you know, that's where the technology comes in, that he imagines the kinds of technology that there will be just like 20 or 30 years from now. It's very interesting, but it's also just beautifully written. I am a previous life. I was an English major, so I love fiction as well. I try to go back and forth between nonfiction and fiction.
Oh, wow. Great. Those are great recommendations. The Age of Surveillance Capitalism is a book that I've been hoping someone would choose to talk about on the show, but I think nobody does because it's so long.
It's long. It's dense.
It's intense. It's an intense book.
It's intense. Yeah.
That is what, I started by telling you that I have like a little aftermarket cover on my camera that I can slide and cover the camera on my laptop. And it was really that book that convinced me I should do that.
So interesting. Yeah. You know, so maybe that'll be me in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll see. If you need the link on Amazon, they're only like $1. I'll send it to you.
Okay, awesome.
Can you just tell our listeners where they can find you? What projects you're promoting? Are you going to be anywhere that you want them to go?
Yeah, so your listeners can, if they're interested, sign up for my newsletter. It's my occasional newsletter that it engages with my research and the ideas from Technology's Child. And you can go to my website to sign up for that. It's katiedavisresearch.com. And there also on my website shows where I'll be. And right now I've just come off of about 6 weeks of a lot of travel. So I'm pretty much staying in Seattle for the foreseeable future, but that'll probably change sooner than I want it to.
Are you coming to LA in the near future, do you think?
Not. I don't have specific plans. I am going to Monterey in about a month to celebrate my uncle's 65th birthday, but not LA. I haven't been to LA in a while because I've been in Berlin for the last 4 years. So.
Oh, wow. And, well, you got to come. If you come, I'll bring a bunch of parents to come see you.
Oh, awesome. Great. Yeah.
And I didn't realize you were in Seattle, but you should know that my T-ball team is the Mariners. So.
Oh, well.
Yes.
Great name. Excellent.
We've become Mariners fans now. So great. Well, Katie Davis, thank you so much. This was super fun. Thank you for your book, and thank you for choosing one of my favorite books. Yeah, we'll have you back on when your next book comes out.
Great. Thank you so much.
The Book Society podcast is brought to you by me, Lucas Cantor Santiago, and produced by Chris Peters. We do new episodes on Fridays. We have a lot of episodes. You can listen to some back catalog. If you like the show, please give it a review. You can review it on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. It takes a few seconds. Helps out the show, helps other people find it, and we really appreciate it. All right, see you next week.
And, you know, what they're basing their decisions on, and hopefully they'll draw on evidence from researchers. But I'm not 100% convinced that they will. But I do think
they won't.
They won't.
I think I can tell you for sure that they won't.